pop culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week, in fact, in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great week for me because I'm back home, having been in Orlando, Florida for the Faith and Freedom Coalition Road to Majority Conference, which was a wonderful success. And there was actually much less bitterness and backbiting than people had expected from that occasion. President Trump had been suspected of making perhaps a surprise appearance. He did not make a surprise appearance, but he did have a surprise Father's Day message, not just for Republicans, but for everybody. We will share that with you. I will give you some indication of my impressions of the good news. And there is mostly good news about the Republican Party and the prospects for actually winning in 2022. There's good news in part because Americans are beginning to get seriously worried about some of the problems concerning rule of law, concerning public safety. That's going to be the big and dominant issue, people say, in the very complicated election coming up tomorrow. It's a primary election in New York City. We will talk a little bit about that. One of the candidates made a bold, I think courageous and insightful comment about homelessness and what to do about it. We will get to that on the Michael Medved Show. There's also a disturbing poll from Gallup that shows that 66% of Republicans, two-thirds, believe that morals in America right now are poor. Why? Why now all of a sudden? And what do we do about it? There is one indication by a scholar from 538 who is just finishing a new book about the sad state of American politics. What's wrong with American politics? Why is it there the general sense that nothing is working in our political life? It is the two-party system, says our guest. And we will be talking to him soon. He believes that part of what would happen would be to emulate the example of the kind of coalition government they just set up in Israel, or to follow what they are doing in New York City now and in a number of other localities and states, including the state of Maine, where they have ranked voting, where you not only have the first choice that you vote for, you have a second choice, third choice, etc. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. And after a little while of some challenges with that phone number, it should be working just fine right now if you want to call through. 1-800-955-1776. Okay, let me just describe to you some of what I found very encouraging about the Road to Majority Conference for the Faith and Freedom Coalition. This, of course, set up by Ralph Reed. And honest to goodness, I've been to virtually all of these. I missed one. Obviously, everybody missed one because they had a cancellation during COVID season last year. And then I missed a previous conference because of an appointment I had with cancer, and which fortunately is in the rear view mirror. But other than that, I've been to all of these conferences, and I really do love it because Ralph and his staff and Joy, who is his assistant, and his family and the people who make the Faith and Freedom Coalition happen do just a superb job. They really do. All the details, everything is operating on time. And look, when you're hurting a bunch of U.S. senators, I mean, I was on the same segment of the program with Senator Ron Johnson, Senator Lindsey Graham. You ever try to keep Lindsey Graham quiet or limit him to it's not going to work. And then, of course, Ted Cruz was in that same, Steve Scalise was in that same array of speakers. But it was all moving along, and it's so highly professional, and it's a pleasure to see that. What I found refreshing is that it was very, very different from what I think people in the media were anticipating for this gathering in Orlando, Florida. What a lot of people were anticipating was there would be lots and lots of stuff about stop the steal, about the stolen election and about conspiracies. And now there were a handful of people, but it really was a handful of people. When Mike Pence spoke at the conclusion of the session that I was in, when Vice President Pence spoke, he was actually very positively received. There were a few people in the back, particularly one lady, who were extremely outspoken about Pence and apparently still wanted to hang him, which, of course, a group of people had wanted to do during the raid on the Capitol building. But Vice President Pence spoke well. Everyone spoke well and constructively. And nothing crazy or nutty or fringy or this is the end of America. Now, there are a lot of confident Republicans who really thought they could win. The one that I had most interaction with, actually, among the prominent national figures was Senator Rick Scott, who is one of two Senators Scott, who I think is going to be running for president. Rick Scott is an amazing guy. I mean, he truly is. So is Tim Scott. Tim Scott is pretty close to my first choice for the Republican nomination in 2024. He's a senator from South Carolina who spoke so spectacularly well at the Republican convention. Well, Rick Scott is the two-term governor of Florida. And when you go back and you look at his two terms and what he did in lowering taxes, simplifying taxes, in terms of putting the spending on a sustainable course in Florida, actually taking some dramatic action to help the Everglades, which environmentalists and people who love the out-of-doors would love. He was a two-term governor of Florida, and he did remarkably well, and he's now the leader of the National Senate Republican Committee. In other words, he is in charge of winning back that at least one seat and holding the other Republican seats. I was at a dinner with Rick Scott, and I had not seen this before because I'd met him. He'd been on the show. He's been on the show a couple of times. But I'd never really seen him in action. And meeting and greeting people, this is a natural politician. He's just somebody you like and who listens to people and who has that ability that I think can be very impressive, not oppressive. I actually was with Rick Scott and a number of other prominent Republicans. There was Senator Gruters, who was the state party chair, was there. He's a state senator. And there was great confidence, not just about Florida, but about the election in general. And the fascinating thing is, in this entire dinner, this was on Thursday night, for the Orange County Republican Party, again, very well organized, very professional, very optimistic, very positive about doing things for the country, not just running down the idea that we are at the eve of destruction or anything of that nature. And there was actually a very good line that Senator Scott used. He said, well, you've heard the story about the three guys who come into a bar. And what do you say when one comes in, he's a Republican, one comes in, he's an independent, and one comes in and he's a Democrat? And what you say is, hello, Charlie. What they're talking about is Charlie Crist, who is running for governor again. Charlie Crist started out as a Republican. He changed into an independent, ran statewide as an independent, lost, then ran and won for Congress as a Democrat. So he's been all three. He's the one who's going to be running against Ron DeSantis, who was another star, the governor of Florida. And again, the enthusiasm for Governor DeSantis, it's very, very different from what you see in most states. We will get to more of that and to people who are trying to enlist me in basically arresting or lynching Mike Pence. I didn't participate, and Mike's fine. But we'll tell you about that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
It is my high honor and distinct privilege to introduce to you my friend,
Michael Medved.
Well, thank you so much, Vice President Pence. And again, he gives a good, solid presentation and was warmly received despite a certain amount of heckling at the Faith and Freedom Coalition Road to Majority Conference in Orlando, which occurred on Thursday and then Friday and through the weekend. I left on Friday morning to get home for the Sabbath, which is an imperative for me. But I was mentioning before that as I was leaving, I spoke about what I considered to be, and I believe this, and I would defend it, by the way, that regardless of what anybody else has to say, I am sure that I am right about this, that the most divisive, the most significant, the most polarizing public issue in America today is not how much we're spending, and it's not gun regulation, and it's not even the human life issue, and it's not national defense. You know what it is? It's how we teach our children to look at their own country. Are we going to try to encourage guilt or gratitude? And that's basically what I spoke about. As I was leaving there, I was being escorted by one of the nice people from the Faith and Freedom Coalition. And somebody came up to me, was a member there, sort of walking vigorously, approaching me, saying, hey, we can count on you, can't we? We can count on you. I said, no, not really, because I'm rushing to catch an airplane. And he said, no, we need to count on you because Mike Pence doesn't belong here. Mike Pence doesn't belong here. He doesn't belong on the podium. He belongs in jail. And then somebody else behind him said he belongs executed. And they obviously were not so happy with Mike Pence. They said, we tried to talk to Senator Ron Johnson, who was speaking on the same platform as I was. And he wouldn't talk to us, but you'll talk to us, won't you? I said, no, I can't. Really, I can't. I've got to catch a plane, which was a good excuse. Because, I mean, these... Okay, so what happened is there was a little bit of a hassle as... And they didn't really make any effort to block my way. It was nothing dangerous. But they did call security, because once you're talking about trying to execute the former vice president or arrest him or do a citizen's arrest, I mean, this was one of the very few discordant notes. The one thing that was most striking to me was that the media that try very hard to make the Republican Party look as fringy and weird as it possibly can didn't really know what to make of what was going on at Faith and Freedom. It was an extremely diverse group. There were an incredibly dynamic black speakers, black pastors who played a very real role in this, and particularly a whole Hispanic section, which had not been there before, of people of every Latino group you could name, who were very strong conservatives and very strong on border security and very strong on basically trying to rejuvenate the Republican Party, which is in process. I will tell you something else. I've been to, I believe Ralph could tell you, I think I've been to 9 of them that I've spoken at. I've been to a lot. And this was by far the biggest one. I asked Ralph about it, Ralph Reed, who's in charge of this thing. There were over 3,000 people there. They kept having to open up new ballrooms. You know the way that they do that sometimes at events. You have one ballroom, and then you take out the wall, and then it becomes two, and then you have to take out another wall, and you have it. This was a huge crowd, and it was the biggest crowd they had ever gotten. And people are very encouraged. And one of the things that I found very encouraging is during the time that I was there, now I was not there the whole time. As I mentioned, I left early to get home for Shabbat with my family. My wife and I had been in New York together. She went directly home from New York. And then I attended the day before Father's Day was our oldest grandson, Micah's first birthday. And it was, we walked over to Micah's house, otherwise known as Shana and Mark's house. And it was just incredible. He was on top of the world. I think he could understand that he was sort of the center of attention for all of these people who were over there for his birthday party. But that was great. And then, of course, there was Father's Day yesterday. And look, you can obsess on sort of weird distractions, but generally, I think everybody who participated in Faith and Freedom was encouraged and encouraging. And I did not hear one mention, one, about stealing the election, about recounting, about Trump being reinstalled as our president by the end of August. And sure, there are people, and there were people there who would like to see him run for re-election, run for renomination. But this was not a Trump-obsessed, either positive or negative, gathering. And I think that's very healthy for the party. Trump did make his own Father's Day announcement. The story from The Independent in the United Kingdom, and it checks out, it's real. Former President Donald Trump wished a happy Father's Day on Sunday to everyone, including his political adversaries, whom he called losers of the world. Mr. Trump, who was banned from Twitter and Facebook, shared the unusual Father's Day message through his political action committee. Quote, happy Father's Day to all, including the radical left, rhinos, and other losers, capital L, of the world. Hopefully, eventually, everyone will come together, the statement read. And then there was another Father's Day announcement from the Trump Organization, which is his business, of course. Today, we celebrate the many incredible fathers throughout our Trump Organization family. Happy Father's Day to you, said the tweet, with a picture of Mr. Trump with Donald Trump and Eric Trump. With Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump. However, the tweet by Mr. Trump attacking his opponents as losers riled some people on social media. Well, of course it did. Joe Biden, his Father's Day announcement to all the fathers, he said, to all the fathers and father figures who enrich our character and love us unconditionally, happy Father's Day to the fathers, stepfathers, grandfathers, and father figures who enrich our character, love us unconditionally, and give so much of themselves every day so we can live lives worthy of their dreams and sacrifices. Okay, very nice. There's also news, and I don't think it's nice to make fun of it, and I certainly don't want to and won't, but Joe Biden's dog died, and it's really a shame. His dog, Champ, who was 13 years old. And the White House announced that he died peacefully. He was a German Shepherd. I'm sure he has gone on to his reward. So what's the reward of a bitterly divided two-party system? And what do we do to fix it before there's a real chance to wreck American democracy? We'll be talking about that with Lee Drutman, who's a senior fellow at the Reform Program at New America, coming up on The MedVet Show. Michael Medved show, I was just talking about some of the optimism and encouragement and confidence that at least was visible at the Republican gathering. It's not officially a Republican gathering, but it really is. Conservative, Republican, mostly religious conservative, at Faith and Freedom Coalition. But right now, that optimism seems to go against a lot of what you hear, which is about how democracy is under threat. It could be dying. It is in trouble. I mean, take a look at Washington, D.C. Everybody says he or she wants infrastructure and spending on infrastructure. They can't even agree on that. So Lee Drutman, who's a fine writer, he's a senior fellow at the Political Reform Program at New America, and he's also the author of the book Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. He's author of a new piece at the 538, which is about how the two-party system is, well, they say it, effing up U.S. democracy. Lee, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Okay. First of all, you clearly would like additional choices. You seem to like the idea of ranked voting, which we're going to see an experiment in New York City tomorrow. You seem to think we should have a multi-party democracy, more in the mold of Israel that you mention in your piece. Where is there evidence of any real surge of support for a third or fourth or fifth party in the United States?
Well, if you look at polling, and I have, and you ask people, do you think the two parties are doing an adequate job or do we need more parties, you find that 60-65% of people say we ought to have more than two parties. When you look at people choosing how they want to identify, whether it's a Democrat or Republican or an independent, you now see 50% of Americans saying, I choose to identify as an independent. So it seems clear to me that people are dissatisfied with the choices that they have, and they want more choices. And frankly, I feel that it would be a much healthier democracy on a number of fronts if we had more parties.
Yeah, except then I was looking at National Journal today, and the Libertarian Party, which has been our most successful third party over a number of years, and it even in 2016 got almost 4% of the presidential vote, which probably swung the election. The Libertarians, it turns out, they just announced today, have been losing members, dues-paying members, and losing ground in fundraising for more than 20 years. Though people say they would like another party, where and how is that going to emerge?
Well, the problem is our system of voting, which we use first past post elections, which make it very hard for third parties to compete, because any vote for a third party becomes seen as a wasted vote. Third parties are seen as spoilers. And so third parties wind up being space where fringe candidates go to emerge, and all energy flows into the two major parties. But if we had a different voting system, if we had a proportional voting system like Ireland or Germany or New Zealand or any of a number of thriving advanced democracies, we would have more political parties, and what you would see was instead of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, you'd see different flavors of parties on the left and different flavors of parties on the right. And the libertarians are not popular because libertarianism isn't very popular. There aren't that many people who want such a limited vision of government. Their policy positions are just extremely unpopular.
There's a lot of what you're saying that makes a great deal of sense. I agree. However, getting from here to there just seems to me completely unthinkable, because we do not, like New Zealand and Ireland, we do not have a parliamentary system. Here in the United States, without changing our Constitution massively, how would a multi-party democracy work here? In other words, right now, you need those 270 electoral votes, right, to be elected president.
Right. Well, I mean, you're thinking about this in a very, very presidential way. Now, there are many democracies around the world that have presidential systems with multi-party legislatures. They don't tend to be in Europe, which are the places where we tend to look. So you can have a presidential democracy that's a multi-party democracy. You can have a parliamentary democracy that's a two-party system, which is basically the UK. I think we often confuse parliamentary and multi-party democracy because we tend to see them go together when we look at Europe. But in reality, those are two different things, that you can have multi-party democracy that has it's in a presidential system. Presidential system just describes a family of systems of government in which the president is elected separately from the legislature, as opposed to a parliamentary system in which the prime minister is elected directly.
Right.
By
would you agree with me that the two parties that exist today, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, have a vested interest in remaining a two-party system in this country?
Do you mean the leaders of the parties? The parties are our organization.
Correct. And that those organizations will work very hard to preserve basically their hold on a two-party system. Because that
I think you have to think about who the leaders are. So will Mitch McConnell want to preserve the two-party system? Absolutely. Will Chuck Schumer want to preserve the two-party system? Probably. But will folks who are rank-and-file Democrats or rank-and-file Republicans who, you know, feel like maybe they're a little frustrated by the direction their party is taking and think that maybe they would do better if they could be part of a smaller party where they could have a stronger say in the direction of that party. You know, I think a lot of them might, in fact, like to be in a smaller party in which they were had more of a say and was closer to their own vision.
Where has that ever worked in the United States? And please don't tell me the Republican Party in 1856, when they first ran a candidate for president. The Republican Party only came into existence after the Whig Party had totally collapsed. And I think you're right.
Wait.
If the Republican Party collapses totally, and doesn't run a candidate, then there's room for another party. But right. I just don't understand how you get from one point to the other.
Well, so this is why you need to change the voting rules, which is totally constitutional, by the way. Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to determine how it runs its elections. And, you know, tomorrow Congress could pass the Fair Representation Act, require multi-member districts for the House with ranked choice voting, and you would have space for new parties to form. So it's fundamentally a legislative choice. Now, I agree, it's not the most likely thing for Congress to do. On the other hand, you know, we've had moments of quite dramatic change in how we run our democracy throughout our history. I mean, we've evolved and changed quite a bit from the 1789 vintage of American democracy, which had direct election of senators, which had no primaries, which had no state-level initiative, which had no voting rights for women. At times we go through periods in which we reevaluate and update our democracy, and I think there's a lot of similarities between this era that we're in now and the late Gilded Age, early Progressive era. In which, you know, Americans were deeply dissatisfied with how democracy worked. And there were high levels of corruption, inequality, tense politics. And we collectively decided that we wanted to have a better, fairer, more representative system. And we made some very big changes.
Okay, the piece is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's about how the two-party system is effing up our democracy. Lee Drutman, thanks for joining us. We will be right back with more on fixing up our system on The Medved Show. Michael Medved Show. Obviously, you could tell by my conversation with Lee Drutman, the author of this piece about how the two-party system is, let's say, lousing up our politics, that I just don't think that any of the things he's talking about, ranked voting nationwide and multi-member districts, in other words, that should have larger congressional districts, but you would have several people, like two people per congressional district, who would be elected. And structural changes of that nature, I don't think they're going to be made. Now, it doesn't mean that I think our system is perfect, but I think it means that our system, with all of its anomalies, and there are plenty of them, basically is very hard to change. The framers set it up that way. You need to get two-thirds vote for a constitutional amendment in both houses of Congress and three-fourths of the state legislatures. Good luck with that. Let me go to your calls to Nancy in Duval, Washington. You're on The Medved Show.
Hi. So I think I want to take issue with what I thought you were saying about the most contentious thing in our country today is the difference between is the teaching of history. And I think that even most liberals want to see something. They just want the truth. We don't want to see history whitewashed, and we don't also want to see that we're the most evil country that ever existed. If we teach the truth, then it will be somewhere in between. And I don't really see that. I think you paint liberals as wanting to see history being taught as we are so evil. And I don't think that's true.
Well, again, if you take a look at, for instance, there's been a great deal of discussion about critical race theory and about the 1619 Project. If you believe, if you want to teach people that America was founded based on slavery, that is not true. That is a slander of the United States. And let me just give you one example of what I mean by that, Nancy, and I'll give you a chance to respond, is that if you look at the founding documents of this country, including the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, going back to the Mayflower Compact, going back to John Winthrop's speech on board the ship, the Arabella, before they landed, there's no mention of slavery. Slavery was not an American invention, nor was it the basis for the founding and the building and the upsurge of our country. And if you're going to insist that in all of our schools that we be taught that slavery is really the original institution on which all of the United States was based, that's a slander.
Well, I just don't think that that's really what we liberals want. Slavery was here from the beginning, and it was a terrible, terrible evil.
Amen.
And maybe even the original sin, I guess some people say. And it couldn't exist. The founders said that it had to exist or the country wouldn't exist because the southern states wouldn't go along with it. So we had to live with this evil for so long. We were definitely not the first to get rid of slavery, maybe not the last, but definitely not the first.
We were certainly the first to build up a major anti-slavery movement, and eventually it broke apart the Union and it happened. But the one point about this is viewing slavery as the crucial institution that allowed America to exist or on which everything was based. And what you're saying is correct, is that at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, a lot of the founders, including founders who had inherited slaves, wanted very much to limit slavery, and they built into that Constitution a mechanism by which the slave trade could be ended into the United States before it was ended into anywhere else, including Britain. We ended the slave trade in 1808, and it was done by President Jefferson at the very first chance he could do so under the Constitution.
But we didn't end slavery nearly the first of any country.
Well, it was pretty near. In other words, if you talk about Russia ended slavery in 1862, we ended slavery in 1865 with the 13th Amendment. And Britain continued to practice slavery in the West Indies, which was part of the British Empire, until it was about a decade before that they got rid of slavery, before we did.
More years of slavery than of freedom in our country.
Well, yeah. Again, it's not. That's also deeply misleading because most of the country did not have slavery. We banned slavery before the Constitution in all of the six states that later became the Upper Midwest: Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and I'm missing one more. But those states, by the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. They all banned slavery from the time those states could be founded. So,
you know, getting back to my original point, I think the truth is what most people want the country, I mean, want the kids to learn in history.
I agree.
And I think it's more of a middle ground. I think, for example, that immigration and abortion are far more contentious than that.
Well, I'll tell you where I disagree with you, because you can sort of split the difference. But if you are going to teach that America committed genocide against Native Americans, which is another slander, which is not true, if you're going to teach that
maybe
America
not
is unique,
genocide, but pretty poorly treated. Pretty poorly treated.
Again, compared to what? See, part of the problem here, Nancy, and it's something that I think is very, very important that people get hold of, is that we don't teach our children about anybody else's history. The focus is all at American history.
Agreed. Agreed.
And when you compare the history of this country, there are reasons why so much of the world has wanted to come here. It wasn't that, people who came here from Sweden and from Bohemia and from all around the world, from India recently, from Nigeria. It's not that they didn't know that America was imperfect. They knew. But compared to every other country on Earth, that's why I don't say, you know, talking about our country every day when I begin the show, I don't start out saying, oh, America, the most perfect country on God's green earth. It's not perfect. We have flaws. And we have dark chapters in our history, there's no doubt. But compared to any other organized nation state ever in the history of the world, I think we're still pretty admirable.
Well,
and I think the...
Even if there are surveys that I have seen which rate countries, for example, on the ability to rise, and the U.S. is not number one. It's kind of far down the list. There are other countries where people have more ability to...
So let me ask you this. Why do you think people, when they want to come to a new country, they still overwhelmingly want to come to the United States? They don't want to go to Belgium. They want to come here.
Well, it is a great country. I'll give you that. And there are opportunities, but...
But of course there are. And by the way, those figures about the relative upward mobility are done by two economists who are both at one time involved in teaching at the University of California at Berkeley. Not that that discredits anything. But America, there are so many success stories and upward mobility stories. And people are more likely, if they are born into poverty, they are, yes, there are some people who get locked into poverty in an intergenerational way, but people are vastly more likely to actually get ahead in this country. If you take a look at black people, for instance, Bill Maher just cited this fact, and you can look it up, it's true, is that there are 13% black people in this country. They're 18% of the entering class at Harvard. And again, the number of percentage of black people who get involved, admitted into four-year colleges and universities, is now miraculously, it's maybe even a little bit above, but certainly at the same percentage of the population. And one of the reasons I like Juneteenth, right, is it should be a time to celebrate some of the remarkable progress, some of the remarkable changes that have been made by this country. And I appreciate, by the way, your calling and engaging in this conversation, but it does seem to me that this is such a basic issue. Do we want the rest of the world to be more like America, or do we want America to be more like the rest of the world? Do we carry a burden of guilt as we look forward to our future, as we look forward to what we're doing right now? Do we have to make up for all the terrible things we've done, or do we have to live up to all of the great things that the people who have come before us have done? And what's striking to me, think about how many people know all about the horrors, and they were horrors, of internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. How few people know what America did for Japan after the war, rebuilding that broken society into one of the strongest and best countries in the world. That is part of the credit and the achievement. And